Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Dr. Wanda Filer, sitting in today for the vacationing Scott Lamar. If I were to ask you, how do you determine whether someone's healthy, you might typically think about blood pressure, their weight, whether or not they're a smoker, maybe even their family history. What you might not think about is their zip code, their level of education, whether they've got food in the refrigerator, or even availability of transportation. We're talking today about social determinants of health. Social determinants of health are quickly becoming the defining thing that decides how healthy both a patient and also their family will be. Joining me is Lisa Allen, the Executive Deputy Secretary at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, and Dr. Stephen Wolf, the Director Emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. A little bit later, we'll be joined by Dr. Margot Savoy, the Chair and Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine at Temple University, who also chairs the Commission on Health of the Public and Science at the American Academy of Family Physicians. We invite you to be part of today's discussion as well. Call us at 1-800-729-7532 or email smarttalk@witf.org. Lisa, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, you are involved with the Department of Human Services, and I know that's the Medicaid program. And so I would imagine that I see many patients with Medicaid and other forms of insurance, I would imagine that social determinants of health is a big consideration for you. Can you tell us what you're thinking and what you're doing with that right now?
Sure, absolutely. At the Department of Human Services, obviously Medicaid is one of our largest areas at DHS. But knowing that we are a social service agency, we have lots of different areas that we're looking at in terms of the social determinants. And as far as what we've looked at with our Medicaid managed care plans specifically, we've been talking to them about how we bring value into the healthcare system. And as part of that, one of the areas that we've been focusing on are the social, environmental, and educational factors for the participants that they see. And as we've gone through with them, looking at that particular area, we brought them all together back in the beginning of the year to talk about what we could do to address things that were outside of just the healthcare space. And it was interesting in that conversation with our managed care plans, they really started to focus on food, housing, educational status, and employment for our participants. And what we found interesting about that was we were talking about healthcare. We had originally intended to focus on what could we do to help individuals become self-sufficient, and employment specifically was our focus. But it was very clear in that discussion that food and housing were the things that they were focused on first. And there was an order to the facts of what they were actually focusing on. Obviously, if you don't have food and you don't have a place to live, thinking about how you have a job and those types of things became less important for that individual in order to get them on the path to self-sufficiency. There was an order to addressing those social determinants. And so we started to talk about what are the programs that they have in place or are they considering to address those types of things with their particular members. And we found that there are lots of interesting pilots that folks are working on. We have several of our managed care plans in the Southeast region that have formed a partnership with MANA, which provides nutritious meals for their participants. It started as kind of a pilot program with a group of diabetic patients and chronic diabetic patients. But now what we're seeing is they're expanding that to lots of other groups of individuals. So food is an area that they're focused on. Housing is another area. One of our managed care plans actually found that they needed to look for individuals that were high utilizers of medical services. And they wanted to focus on housing, but they started to look at, well, how would I do that in our particular area? And that led them to a partnership with one of the homeless shelters. And they did a cross match of individuals between themselves and the homeless shelter who was having folks visit them. And they found 500 individuals within their panel that actually were homeless and using that facility as their place of residence. And so they started to develop a partnership with that group. And identified those individuals, and now they've started to see improvement in health outcomes by having more of a health focus on site at that homeless shelter. So looking at those types of things have been very interesting in terms of how it's addressing the actual healthcare costs and healthcare needs. So we're very excited about this work.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing all of that. Dr. Scott Wolf, again, from the Chair, Director Emeritus at the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. I know you've done some really interesting things. I've heard some presentations before regarding education as a determinant of health. Can you fill us in on that, please? And welcome to Smart Talk.
Thank you. It's Steve Wolf, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Glad to be here. Important conversation. I think before delving into education, I just want to underscore the fact that when we talk about social determinants of health, many of your listeners may not appreciate how big a deal this is. I'm a physician, and you'll be hearing from a family physician like myself later in the program. Research shows that what doctors do in doctors' offices and hospitals only accounts for about 10 to 20% of our health outcomes. And we have very big differences in health in our country. If you take a city like Philadelphia, for example, our research has shown 20-year differences in life expectancy between neighborhoods that are just a few miles apart. And when we try to understand why we have such big gaps in our health, it's important to understand that it involves these social determinants of health. Healthcare is obviously important. It's something we consider necessary, but it's not sufficient to improve our health because our ability to not only prevent disease but to manage chronic illnesses depends a lot on healthy behaviors and also our environment in which we live. And those have a huge impact on our health. One important aspect of this is our socioeconomic status, especially in an economy like America's economy, which people talk about as a knowledge economy. It's an era where having a good education is a pathway to better jobs, higher income. And that's important not only because it provides resources for people to afford health insurance coverage and have other benefits that improve their health, but it also gives people the economic mobility to live in healthier neighborhoods and places where there are parks and green space for children to play outside and get physical activity, to have access to healthy foods and to be able to afford them, and to live in a neighborhood that has clean air and clean water and is safe and free from violence and a variety of other factors that shape our health. So education turns out to be hugely important in shaping our health. This also may not come as a surprise to your listeners. It's sort of intuitive that education and, you know, the previous examples of food and housing are important to your health, but people may not appreciate how big an impact this has. Some examples would be that the prevalence of heart disease is twice as high if you haven't graduated from high school compared to if you've had a college education. The prevalence of diabetes is three times as high. Studies have shown that middle-aged Americans are three times more likely to die from diabetes if they lack a high school diploma than if they've had at least some college education. So we're talking very big numbers here.
Very interesting. I am a family physician. I can resonate with everything you've just said. I see this on a regular basis. As a reminder, you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. We're talking about social determinants of health with Lisa Allen from Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Dr. Stephen Wolf from the Center on Society of Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. We also will be joined by another guest. I think she may be joining us soon, Dr. Margot Savoy from Temple University, the professor of family and community medicine. So, Dr. Wolf, you mentioned the importance of education, and are there things that you believe that can be done in the public policy arena or that you have been seeing that are being done that can positively impact and really change the trajectory of lives for patients?
Well, obviously, when we talk about education of young people, people tend to assume that this is a long-term proposition, that investments that are made in education of our youth are not going to pay returns off for decades to come. And certainly there are long-term benefits that come from those investments. But the actual benefits of these improvements in education are also in the short term as well. So if you think about children with asthma or ADHD or other kinds of issues, studies have shown that investments during the preschool period to help children enter kindergarten and elementary school better equipped to succeed not only improve their learning experiences and their academic outcomes, but also have effects on these important childhood illnesses, as well as their likelihood of developing obesity and other problems as teenagers. Obviously, all aspects of the educational pathway, from preschool all the way through college, are important. The strongest research, though, is in pre-K education. Studies have shown huge benefits from getting our young people ready for success in schools. But we also need to improve outcomes in secondary school, and importantly, in an economy like ours, make college more affordable for young people graduating from high school, especially disadvantaged populations that face greater challenges because of the high cost of tuition. But it's also important when we talk about education to not forget about adult workers. We have many blue-collar and manufacturing jobs that are disappearing and threatening the middle class, and many workers need job retraining to acquire the work skills so that they can obtain higher-earning jobs and improve the health and economic success of their families. So we are seeing more examples of interventions in communities that are two-generation interventions, where efforts are being made to improve childhood experiences, but also to help equip the parents with better job skills.
Lisa, when he was making some of those comments, you were nodding. Can you give me your thoughts?
Sure. One of the other areas that we've been looking at as we've kind of talked about the social determinants of health is, what are we doing for the participants that we serve through our temporary assistance for needy families programs, our supplemental nutrition assistance program, and how do we help those individuals as well? In many instances, we're looking at individuals who have various needs, but what can we do to assist them? And one of the areas that we've focused on, and we also have our Office of Child Development and Early Learning, that is really focused on how do we improve the early child care experience for the members that we have in our programs. And ensuring that children and families have access to high quality child care and early learning programs that help identify potential challenges is a critical area. We've actually gotten some additional funding in this year's budget to provide for some increases in our nurse family partnership program and our home visiting programs, which we think are also critical to helping new moms who are experiencing challenges understand how to care for their children, what are the next steps in early learning for their children, but also encouraging them as the parent to seek out some of the other things that they were hoping to do and meet some of their goals around education and training. So it really is that two-generational approach that we're trying to look at in terms of not only the young children, but also the parents that are with our young children, making sure that they have the opportunities to seek education and training along with their children and supporting them through child care programs that are of high quality and programs that offer them some of that extra help as they become new parents.
Excellent. Thank you. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Dr. Wanda Filer. We're discussing social determinants of health with Lisa Allen, the Executive Deputy Secretary at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Dr. Stephen Wolf from the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, and joining us now is Dr. Margot Savoy, the Chair and Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine at Temple University and a longtime friend. Margot, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you give us some insight, your perspective as a family physician on social determinants of health and specifically what you're doing at Temple, as well as some of your national view?
Absolutely. Happy to share. So from our perspective, you know, social determinants of health are like the bread and butter of what we do in family medicine. family physicians are uniquely trained to be able to take care of patients from their entire lifespan, from birth until, honestly, till death. And so part of what we do is spend a lot of time focusing on how to take care of the family as a unit. And when you try to take care of families, one of the things you figure out pretty quickly is that where they live, where they work, and where they play has a direct impact on their ability to live a healthy life. And so social determinants of health are near and dear to almost every family physician I know of heart, but particularly to our academy and then also to me here at Temple. The nice thing about the National Academy, so the American Academy of Family Physicians, is actually taken on trying to help their members figure out how to handle social determinants of health more recently through a project called the Everyone Project, which I'm really excited about, partly because I got to be a part of developing it, but also because we see how its use is going to be transformational for a lot of practices, just being able to figure out how to help their patients live their best life and their most healthy life. The idea of the Everyone Project is to sort of put tools in your hands when you're seeing patients in the office. It's going to be able to help them when they're not in your office anymore. So it has four strategic priorities, so things that they're really trying to focus on. One is sort of built in on workforce diversity and having people available who actually understand where you're coming from and be able to relate to you and to be able to make sure that they understand the challenges that you're facing in your community. One is advocating for health equity, so not just thinking about it inside the exam room, but making sure that we've got policies that are addressing health equity both at the local, state, and federal level. Thinking about interdisciplinary collaboration, so having ways for us to work together with our colleagues in the community, be that public health or be that your community health worker or the local church down the street. And then the fourth one is around education and practice-based resources, so that although we do believe that most of this work is going to happen outside of your practice, there's work that you can do inside the practice where you can sort of help to get patients going in the right direction. And so we're working on that sort of on the national level. Locally, I find this incredibly helpful. At Temple, I'm very blessed because I have a really strong team that is able to connect not just to the family medicine side, but to the other resources that Temple has to offer to help care for our community. Specifically, our faculty are partnered with the Center for Bioethics, Urban Health, and Policy. And in that group, there are a lot of projects that we've been able to do, sort of reaching out to the community and addressing our most pressing needs. Off the top of my head, two of them that have really made a big difference. One is around medication-assisted therapy and making sure that we're helping our patients get connected to resources to help them with their opiate addiction, and not just addressing the patient getting their medication, but also addressing them, making sure they get their mental health services, and now broadening that out to think about whether their family is getting the care they need to help support the person with the addiction. And then another level or another project that we've been working on is around trauma-informed schools in the city of Philadelphia. We're partnering with Philadelphia Ceasefire to work with two schools that are in our neighborhood, one's at Bethune and the other one's at Kensington. And we're working with kindergartners to eighth graders to try to think about violence prevention and what does that mean to them as children and how we can help to make them better. And so it's sort of opportunities to help people realize that there's more to family medicine than just taking care of making sure you get your blood pressure medicine refilled or that you've got, you know, your normal well child check, but making sure that we're actually reaching outside of the exam room and helping people where they live.
Thank you. I have a caller who, from Carlisle, Mary, who couldn't stay on the line, and I'll open this to the three of you to see what your thoughts. She said that as a child, she went with her mother, who was a community health nurse, to migrant camps and on home visits. What role do public health nurses play today in underserved communities? Lisa, do you have thoughts there?
Sure. So as we've talked with our Medicaid managed care plans, the one area that we've been also focusing on is actually serving individuals in the communities where they are. So we've invested some additional dollars in what we call community-based care management. And as those plans look to address social determinants of health, they have various ways of working with community health workers, public health nurses, and others that can go out into the community and meet people where they are. One of the challenges for the populations that we serve is often transportation. And so actually being able to go to where the individual is and provide them with assistance to navigate either through their health care system and through the appointments, or if they're looking for where food pantries are or assistance with housing. A lot of those community health workers and public health nurses have that expertise because they're in the communities and have been able to address some of those issues for us.
Another really important idea about being able to bring the care directly to people where they are is that we often take for granted that everyone has days to take off for being sick. And for many of us, they don't have time off to be able to come to you. So even if they could get transportation, they can't just take off the day of work without losing significant amounts of pay. And for a lot of folks, that's not affordable. And so it's fantastic to have the ability to bring care directly to where the patients are so they don't have to find someplace else to go or another way to get their medication or get their care.
What I would add, aside from these logistical advantages of coming into the community and meeting them where they are, is that for many populations of color and other groups that are struggling with neighborhood conditions, there are issues of trust and questions about whether these people showing up to help them actually understand the neighborhood and the lived experience. So a lot of efforts are focused on engaging community health workers, lay workers, navigators, and in the case of the Hispanic Latino community, promotoras and so forth, that have a connection with local residents that not only helps them feel a trust and confidence that these are people who understand what it's like in the neighborhood, but on top of it also know how to access these important resources to help them.
You know, in the United States, we spend more than twice what the next closest developed country spends per capita on health care. And yet, when you look at the outcomes around the 11 most developed nations, we rank right near the bottom on most of them. Do you believe that social determinants of health are part of that issue, that we've not perhaps paid enough attention to some of the, if you will, the Maslow hierarchy of need, the basic food and housing and the basic survival that people need in order to succeed?
Absolutely.
I'll give a short and a long answer to this one. The short one is yes. The long answer is that I had the opportunity to chair a National Research Council panel that issued a report in 2012 on this very subject. We compared the health of Americans with people in 16 other high-income countries, and we found exactly what you said, not only for life expectancy, but for dozens and dozens of different health outcomes, from birth all the way through to Alzheimer's disease. Americans have higher mortality rates, higher prevalence of diseases than their peers in other countries, and we undertook a systematic examination of why that is, and there's lots of potential explanations. For example, our healthcare system is the only one of those that is not a universal healthcare system, so access to healthcare is obviously a bigger challenge in this country, and there are other issues like guns and obesity and so forth that distinguish Americans from people in other countries. But if I had to pick one category that our research identified as being the most likely culprit, it is this wide social and income inequality that we have in the country and the lack of investment in helping people with these social needs. Just as you said, we spend far more on health care than do other countries. We spend far less per capita on social services than those other countries. So a poor person in Canada or France or Japan has more support systems available to help them cope with difficult times than a similar person in America.
Well, it's interesting, too, because when we think about the healthcare system, just the fact that we think about it as a healthcare system and yet it's not focused on health, it's actually focused on illness, is problematic. So that if you were really thinking about how you'd want to keep a population healthy, you'd want to back up two steps and start preventing some of the illnesses. And many of the chronic diseases that we're sort of struggling with today are things that come from your inability to access healthy food or to have a safe place to exercise or to have the money to be able to afford some of the other luxuries that we'd like to think about. So we spend a lot of money on very expensive things on the back end after people have already gotten ill. But we do not do a very good job of investing on the front end with all the preventative care, things like vaccines and making sure that you're getting healthy diet choices, even as a child, knowing what your options are, how to choose the best foods for you to keep you healthy and well, making sure that we protect things like exercise in school. there's a lot of things that we just don't really invest in as a society, which is problematic. And I think it lends itself greatly to thinking about the social determinants of health, because sometimes you may be able to overcome that, because when you go home, you may have a different situation where you may not have, you know, play time, for example, during the day at school, but when you come home, there's a park around the corner from you, and so it's easy to go play. If you're living in a neighborhood where that's not safe or it doesn't exist, then you really don't have outdoor time or time to go and run around and really get your exercise in, or access to a grocery store, which many of us take for granted. It's just not available in some neighborhoods at all. And so thinking about how are you going to fix some of the chronic diseases if you're not able to do the basic core things that people need. And if you don't have a place to sleep so that you can get a good night rest, I don't know how we expect anyone to function to do anything.
Right. And just to add to that, I think in the Medicaid space, the Medicaid managed care plans over time have seen this shift. We've focused on chronic disease management, and it's been a care management model that has been focused on the diseases and not necessarily on what are the outcomes that we're getting for the patients that we're serving. And so what we've been trying to do, and I think the plans have started to move in this direction and seen this as well, is they really need to focus on case management of sorts and looking at the whole person from a total population health perspective, focusing not just on the disease, but what are the other social factors that are affecting that disease. And to do that, we've also encouraged them to move towards more of a value-based purchasing arrangement with their providers so that it incentivizes them as well as their providers to not just look at an office visit or a healthcare need, but look at the total needs of that particular individual and reward that provider and pay for the services that actually will seek the results that we're looking for the populations. And that could be a multitude of things outside of just a healthcare visit and a well child checkup and medication visits. Those are all important aspects of this, but there are also the other things that we've all just mentioned that are outside of the healthcare office itself.
Amen. I have, you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. We're talking with Lisa Allen, Dr. Margot Savoy, and Dr. Stephen Wolfe. We're going to welcome your questions and your comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on witf.org or on WITF's Facebook page. Again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. We do have an email. This is just an excerpt from a longer email. A listener has emailed, what happens to people who are too old for Medicaid, but too young for Medicare? I have known people who were too old, but too young for Medicare, and I'm not certain they will get into Medicare. And that is shameful because they've worked hard to support industry in America.
Well, from a Medicaid perspective, there is no age limitation on being eligible for Medicaid. It is a means-tested program, so it does depend on income and circumstances of the individual, but there is really no age range. So I would encourage that individual, if in fact they believe that they are eligible, that they contact us. We have an online application. Our Compass application is online and can certainly fill out that application. If they are not eligible for Medicaid, then we will look to see if there are other healthcare resources available that they might be qualified for.
And I will add to this. This is Dr. Filer. I work at a federally qualified health center, Family First Health, down in York, and we have offices in Adams and Lancaster as well. And we often see patients who kind of fall in between here, and yet they're still, because it is a federally supported system, these are all over the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as well as the country, we will take care of people. I like to tell patients, we don't turn you away. I had a patient in just a couple weeks ago who said to me she was afraid to come in because she thought she was too dirty. And I said, well, first of all, you're not dirty, and secondly, even if you were, we would love to see you. And you could see the picture of relief spread across her face. Dr. Wolfe and Dr. Savoy, any thoughts here for this listener or this person with the email, how you might help these patients who aren't sure how to access care in this country, which, as you've previously mentioned, can sometimes feel really foreign and difficult?
And so from my perspective, I mean, I take a very similar approach to what you just described. I tell people that it's almost always better to call or come in, because even if I can't fix it myself, so I will fully admit up front that there's a lot of things that I don't know how to fix personally, but I know people. And so when you know people, you're able to connect folks to other folks who may be able to make it better. So we've got social workers and care managers. We've got access to a wide variety of resources that we can link people to. I know that in our office, we tend to use a tool called Aunt Bertha, which has a lot of different things where you can search a person's zip code, and you can link it to where you want that thing to search. So it'll actually go through and search for things like food pantries and other resources that they can use. So even if I can't find you the exact thing that you thought you needed, we might be able to piece together something else that at least gives you the care that you need at the end of the day while we figure out how to get all the other stuff sorted out. I do know that even in the office, it's very rare that we would have a person who just doesn't get seen because they showed up and they're unable to figure out their insurance plan. Like, we often will just see them and we'll figure out the other part later. And so I would really encourage anyone who's really concerned or very worried to show up first. One thing I do like to mention to folks, though, is that it probably is not your best choice to show up in the ER as your first point of entry unless you really have something emergently wrong. And part of the reason for saying that is that when we think about bills and how you're going to get things written off and figure out how to pay for it, oftentimes I find that patients who are worried about their ability to access primary care will go to the ER first because they think it's cheaper for them to have gone to the ER. And in reality, it's often not. So they have very long wait times and much higher expenses than if they had just contacted us to come into the primary care office first. And so I encourage them to come in, and often we can connect you to a lot of those same resources right from the office.
Very good. Great advice. Thank you very much. Lisa, you mentioned earlier about Nurse Family Partnership Program, and we run one of those down in York, and quite honestly, it's transformative for many of these families. Can you share, please, with our listeners some background about what that program entails?
Sure. The Nurse Family Partnership Program is actually an evidence-based program that seeks to serve first-time moms with children up to age 2. And generally, those are individuals who are low income but do have other social needs. And just understanding how to become a parent is difficult and challenging. I know being a parent, it's kind of trial and error. And when you are in an isolated area or you don't have a lot of the resources, these are the types of programs that allow for an individual, a nurse, to actually come into your home and help you with understanding about child care, around parenting, connecting you to resources in the community, setting goals for you as the parent, as well as goals for you and your child. It helps with developmental screenings and making sure that your child is actually getting the well child visits that they should be getting up to that age of two. But Nurse Family Partnership is just one of the programs that we sponsor. We also have Parents as Teachers and some other programs that aren't as limited by income and aren't limited by age of the child. So home visiting is something that we are encouraging for a multitude of reasons, just from an early child care perspective, but also focusing on the parent and making sure that they are getting what they need as they continue the journey of parenting. And I will say at DHS, Secretary Miller, who is a first-time mom and has a young child, age of two, actually was very intrigued by the Nurse Family Partnership Program and the Parents as Teachers Program, and said, well, why can't I have one of these? And so she actually does have a home visitor now that is visiting her home and working with her and her young child. So experiencing it firsthand and seeing exactly how the program works and what the benefits are, I think has been absolutely wonderful for her to see, but it also supports what we're seeing with these types of programs.
Excellent. You can hear today's show and previous editions of Smart Talk on WITF.org/podcast or with the WITF app. You can also hear the entire program tonight at 7. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Dr. Wanda Filer. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing social determinants of health with our guest today, Lisa Allen, the Executive Deputy Secretary at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Dr. Margo Savoy, the Chair and Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine at Temple University, and Dr. Stephen Wolf, Director Emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at the Virginia Commonwealth University. I want to pose a question to you. I see patients in quite a few small communities in central Pennsylvania and in rural Pennsylvania, and many of these patients have great difficulty with transportation. They either can't get in to see me, their car has broken down, or they have one vehicle that they're sharing amongst family members who have to go to work. Is there any possibility, is there any relief for these individuals who have these? I've heard some programs that some other parts of the country are, you know, even paying for Lyft or Uber and so forth. I know it's a problem. For instance, we worry about patients who maybe miss a chemotherapy appointment because they don't have dependable transportation. What advice might we have here in the Commonwealth for some of these folks?
Well, from those individuals who actually participate in our Medicaid program, we provide transportation through our medical assistance transportation program, and it is a program that requires that the individual actually be eligible for Medicaid, that they work with their local transportation organization in order to schedule those trips. But we do offer that transportation. What we end up finding is that in many instances, folks either don't know about that program, or they have trouble accessing the program. And so that's another area where we have had our managed care plans focusing specifically on what are the barriers for their participants. And if transportation is a barrier, how are they assisting with arranging that transportation? So in some instances, community health workers are actually going out to the patient, they're assisting them with the transportation to those types of appointments. But in general, we are looking at the transportation structure within our organization as well as across our sister agencies to see how we can more seamlessly offer transportation, because we know it's a barrier for individuals.
I'd like to make a point here that I think needs some emphasis when we talk about social determinants of health. We have an overpopulation of doctors on this program, and we're looking at it through the healthcare lens. And even that term, social determinants of health, is jargon that we use in the health field. But these social problems that we're talking about, the listeners know this very well, are affecting many aspects of their lives. So transportation is a good example. Yes, lack of transportation is a barrier to getting to the doctor, but it's also a barrier to getting to work, or getting to childcare, or getting to the store to purchase healthy foods if you're in a rural area and the closest Walmart is the only place where you can get fresh produce, and that's a county away. Lack of transportation is an issue there. The social factors that we're talking about have far-reaching consequences that affect not only our access to health care, but so many of the different resources in life that we need for the economic stability of our families and for improving our health. The policy significance of that is that we need to think sort of holistically about this set of social problems. In healthcare and in many of the programs we've talked about, there is a shift toward wraparound services that deal with these in concert with each other. But there are other kinds of strategies apart from healthcare, both in the public policy space in terms of what federal, state, and local policymakers can do, as well as community-based solutions that help people address this set of issues that, without being addressed in concert, are unlikely to have transformative change.
Dr. Zafoy, you were going to add something?
So the other thing that I've heard happening in parts of the country, which isn't happening quite as much here in Philadelphia yet, but telehealth, so that although many people may not have access to be able to get to a provider's office, if they may have access to a cell phone or be able to access the Internet in another way, and that there are many things that people are getting managed for that you might be able to appropriately do over the phone. It might be difficult, but being able to see them through a video, you might be able to answer the question or take care of it, and that may be a way that people don't have to necessarily travel as far to get to their visit. And I think there's something to be said for really giving some thought to how can we leverage the technology that we have available to help everyone, not just some people. So if I can, you know, if I can figure out a way now to click an app that brings food to my house, that can also deliver my groceries, that can help me get to my doctor's appointment by just doing it over the phone, that allows me to do other things, that there may be ways to make those things more seamless and much more straightforward for folks to access, regardless of where they are in the country.
Very good. And Dr. Wolf, I appreciate your comment about being doctor heavy. I love that. So I want to ask another question. One of the things I think we perhaps need to think about that is not inherently, people don't think about it as a health issue, but the built environment, what people refer to as the built environment. Dr. Savoy mentioned earlier people who, for instance, may not have a park next door where their kids can safely go outside and play. For any of you, do you see any work being done in thinking of how we do design in this country, how we put together neighborhoods or maybe redesign? What thought is going into any of that work around the country?
So this is one of those questions that I think it makes me chuckle, because it makes me think that if we'd said this to my grandmother, she would have laughed at all of us, because now we want to redesign things that people used to do just fine, and we decided to undo them. So this idea of having walkable communities where you could walk to the store and you could walk to where you wanted to go without having to worry about getting hit by a car is something that we don't realize nowadays as often, because the way we've sort of built things, it makes it somewhat unsafe for you to ride your bike or to take a car, to not have your car to be able to get from place A to place B. But there used to be a time when people had communities where you really could walk and do most of the things you needed to do from foot, which eliminates some of that challenge. But then also it keeps your things sort of local enough that you're getting your exercise during the day without having to think that hard about it or do extra things. And so unless you're living in the city, like, it's really kind of hard to walk too much of anywhere. And so I think that idea is something that I see people bringing back in pockets of places. But unfortunately, from what I can tell, it's in pockets of places with people with pretty decent resources. And so that if you're not necessarily in those spaces, you still may not have what was considered a walkable community that allows you to get to where you need to go without necessarily having to pay for transportation, either on a subway or any other kind of form.
There is an increasing effort in the urban planning world to recognize the importance of these health issues. And although I definitely agree that most of the investments that are being made in bicycle paths and other kinds of built environment features are happening more in affluent neighborhoods, we are beginning to see more and more efforts at developing mixed-income housing and other kinds of construction in low-income, disadvantaged communities, where the design teams are thinking about how to introduce design features in their construction for low-income residents to have better access to green space, parks, opportunities for cycling and walking, and so forth. I do want to just mention, and we can come back to it later if there's time, that with all this focus on the physical environment, which is hugely important, we don't want to forget about the importance of the social environment. There's a growing body of evidence now that our health is shaped not only by whether we have a park or a sidewalk, but also by what we in our field call social capital, how tightly knit the fabric of your community is, and the sense that your neighbors have your back. And conversely, when we live in an environment that's traumatic, where people, especially young people, are exposed to stress, chronic stress, and anxiety due to conditions in their families or what's going on in the neighborhood, that this produces very adverse consequences. In young children and the developing brain, we talk about the impact of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, which cause all kinds of problems both in their development and in their future risk of developing unhealthy behaviors and diseases even as adults. We now know that many of the health disparities that we see in different population groups and in different neighborhoods of our cities and rural communities are caused by these differences in our social environment.
It's interesting you bring that up, because one of the things I noticed as they sort of redevelop in the city particularly is that it tends to be that they'll come in and they'll bring in a developer, they redevelop the area to make it much nicer and to have the things that we're talking about. But then they outprice the people who lived in that neighborhood previously, so then they now can't afford to live there. And so in breaking up their community, you don't just break up the fact that they can't live in the house that they had before, but you also break up the network that they had of community support and folks that they knew well, that they could rely on. And I see that happening a lot in the city, that as people are buying up the space to make it nicer and walkable and have all these lovely things, that they basically displace all the residents who were there before, and often they don't have the ability to take their space back. They sort of just get moved along somewhere else.
Exactly. This is the problem of gentrification that we're seeing in so many cities that are pricing people out of the neighborhoods they grew up in and displacing them.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. We're talking about social determinants of health with Lisa Allen, Dr. Margot Savoy, and Dr. Stephen Wolf. I'm going to take an email here. This is an email from Kit. He says, I have an annual appointment with my primary health care doctor. He always encourages a colonoscopy, which I decline, but my family history is heart and pulmonary issues. I'm overweight and close to having type 2 diabetes, yet there isn't any suggestion involving a dietitian. It seems as if medication isn't involved. The logical alternative is overlooked. Take your comments.
So I'll take that one. So I actually spent a lot of time talking about diet and exercise in our practice. But I'll be honest with you, like most of the time, the recommendation ends up falling on deaf ears only because people can't afford the copays that it costs to go to the nutritionist, or often the nutritionist isn't a covered benefit unless they have diabetes already diagnosed. And so one challenge that we've had is figuring out how to deliver that same content in a way that doesn't generate the copay or doesn't generate the visit that they can't afford to have. And I'll tell you, it's a challenge in a primary care space where you only have so much time with the patient to figure out how to make that work. But I absolutely agree that food and exercise are two critical things that could actually prevent many of the chronic diseases that we're seeing right now if we were able to address it better.
So in the Medicaid space, one of the areas that we are focusing on is not just diabetes, and we cover diabetes counseling, diabetes services, so all of those services are covered, but we're really focusing on the prevention aspect and diabetes prevention, and that's something that we're adding to our agreements with our managed care plans in January so that we start to look at it as from the preventative perspective, and also includes all of the counseling and the recommendations for the dietitians, et cetera. So absolutely a critical area that needs to focus.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to take what I think is an absolutely fabulous email from John. He said, you mentioned but did not give nearly enough attention to two foundational factors. Number one, the current and growing income inequality in the United States, and second, the failure to implement universal health care. I'll take your comments.
I agree. I think honestly, if we had a big magic wand and we could figure out how to eliminate a lot of the health disparities, so not even just thinking about the social determinants of health, but the health disparities that we see across groups. Honestly, income inequality is a huge deal, not even just in the groups that people think about. So it's not even as simple as, you know, one racial group versus another racial group. It's also even the income inequality between men and women, and that women living independently have a harder time being able to make the same amount of money and to be able to sort of close that gap and be able to care for themselves. And so I 100% agree. And universal health care, I was so excited because I really felt like under the previous administration, we were heading in a direction that really resonated with what I thought was best for the patients that I care for and the people who are in my family, that I just wanted to make sure that everyone had access to the same level of health care that I'm afforded because I happen to have a job. And so I'm a little bit disappointed at some of the rollbacks and things that have been sort of taking place more recently. But I really hope that people fully appreciate that the ability to access care doesn't have to take away care from someone else, that it really can make a difference in the lives of some folks. And we were really, truly changing lives and helping people when they finally had access to be able to come into the office and get the medicines that they needed. And I really hope we take that into account as we go forward.
Thank you.
And I would just say we are completely on board with that as well. That was one of the first things that Governor Wolf did when he took office was expand Medicaid, which gave access to health care to over 700,000 more individuals. And every day we're looking at opportunities to increase that number and make sure that others have access to health care because we've seen such a tremendous growth in the numbers of people covered and the reduction in the uninsured and actual access to health care services. So we're completely on board with that.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have time for. I want to thank our guests today, Lisa Allen, the Executive Deputy Secretary at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Dr. Margot Savoy, the Chair and Associate Professor of Family and Community Medicine at Temple University, and Dr. Stephen Wolf, the Director Emeritus at the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. You can hear today's show and previous editions of Smart Talk at WITF.org/podcast or at the WITF app. You can also hear the entire program tonight at 7. I'm Dr. Wanda Filer.